T-minus 4 days now until Election Day in Boston, early voting underway. Both candidates are on a campaign blitz trying to get in front as many as voters as possible before Tuesday, and I mean the candidates for mayor. And as a result, we are grateful that they've both carved out some time to join us on Radio Boston this week and take your calls. Yesterday, Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu joined us. Today, we have Councilor Anissa Asaibi-George. Councilor Asaibi-George, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much, Tiziana, for having me on.
Glad to have you. And listeners, Councilor Asaibi-George is taking your calls. What do you want to ask? And I will note, we're going to do the same thing as yesterday. We're going to try to limit our questions to people who are not actively volunteering for or working on the campaign. That number, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Councilor Asaibi-George, you know, I want to note, we saw each other at a debate that I helped co-moderate on Monday night. We did a town hall together last Thursday. I really appreciated the way you and Councilor Wu, who did one last Monday, engaged with us. We deeply engaged with who you are as a person running for mayor. Thank you for that. Now let's engage that same way on policy. And I want to start with schools. On a number of occasions during the campaign, you've been asked if you support the current Boston Public School Superintendent, Brenda Casselius. I've noted your answer usually says some version of, I support her working in conjunction with me as mayor. Why that qualified response? What are you saying there?
Well, I'm saying that as a former, as a BPS graduate myself, as a former classroom teacher, you know, I spent 13 years in the classroom as a BPS parent and the chair of education. I intend as mayor to be very directly involved in the work that is happening over at the Boston School Department for the benefit of our children across the district. It's really important to me, both personally and professionally, that we are doing right by our kids and that we are doing things every day to improve their academic outcomes and to support them socially and emotionally. Every kid in the Boston Public Schools deserves a high-quality academic and educational experience, and I want to ensure that they get it.
So I just want to note for our listeners, you are on the go today. We are catching you between campaign events. You're on a cell phone. Just to note, your sound's cutting in and out a little bit, but this is important. We are going to stay with it. Let me follow up with you on that. So Boston Public Schools is dealing with some more turmoil this week. Parents of students at three elementary schools don't know where their children will be going to school next year, which is the result of two more middle schools being closed at the end of the year. Those parents also recently informed that their current elementary schools won't be expanding to include sixth grade. Is this growing pains or is this a failure of communication and planning on behalf of the Boston Public Schools? Is this a failure?
This is a failing for sure, absolutely, for these families. I talked to a number of parents this week who have been impacted by this move. I am, you know, certainly supportive and think that the grade reconfigurations that we are underway with the Boston Public Schools is an important one, but we cannot lose sight of the impact that has on so many of our kids. We need to move to add sixth grade to those schools that are feeling the pain the most, and we've got a number of K to five schools in our district. We need to make sure that the seats are either added to those school communities or there is a you know, information shared pretty quickly over the next couple of weeks for which schools have sixth grade seats for those students to attend next school year.
So I'm hearkening back to debates before the preliminary election where there was a lot of public anger towards Superintendent Casselius for communication and planning around buses. Now you're saying this is a BPS failure as well. How much of this is on Superintendent Casselius, and do you continue to support her in her role?
You know, this is, in the end, the success or the failure of the Boston Public Schools really exists with the superintendent and with the mayor of this city. And that's part of why I don't know whether we'll talk at all this afternoon about the role of the Boston School Committee in the work of leading the Boston Public Schools. I want that responsibility. And I think, you know, one of our greatest challenges has been our inability to effectively communicate with and connect to our school families. And this here is an example of that. We need to move these K to fives to K to sixes, and that has to happen in conjunction with the closings of these middle schools. And we've got a couple of middle schools that are preparing for closure for the next school year that has created this ripple effect. We always have to pay attention to unintended consequences and move to fix that. You know, we've got a problem right here, and we've got to move to fix that. And I need the system and the superintendent to be nimble enough to fix the problem that we see here today.
Okay, I am going to move to phones in a moment, but you brought up the school committee, so let's stay with that for a second. Voters expressing their preference next week for elected versus appointed. Recent polls show more than, well, over 50% support among those polled for an elected school committee. Your position is in support of an appointed school committee. Why, and what's your message to voters who want to have some sense of direct control over who represents them on that committee?
Well, first, I supported this non-binding referendum to be put on the ballot this year because I think it's important for us as a city to have a very critical conversation about the role of the school committee in our schools and with our families, their position, whether elected, their governance structure, whether elected or appointed. Although I do prefer and want an appointed body because I think it's important for the city to be able to, for the city's people and our families and our students in particular, our school communities, to hold someone accountable for the success and failures of the school district. With an appointed body, I feel that we've added, I feel that we add too much more politics to it. Sorry, I'm jumbling my words there, but the politics, there are enough politics as it stands today in public education here in the city of Boston. And to move towards a fully elected body, we see that there will be much more finger pointing and certain interests that maybe we don't want involved in public education as it relates to the decisions that school committees make and this one will make. I do support a student to have the right to vote on this body, and I want the buck to stop with me. We as a city have never elected a former classroom teacher, and so not only am I a BPS grad and a BPS mom, but I'm also a BPS teacher, and that those experiences I think will better prepare me to lead in partnership with not just our superintendent and the school committee, but our school leaders and our educators and our families, lead for the future of better outcomes for our kids.
You're listening to Radio Boston in the second of our conversations with the two Boston mayoral candidates. Today we have Boston City Councilor Anissa Asaibi-George. She is taking your calls, your questions at 1-800-423-8255. We have Yasmin on the line in Dorchester. Yasmin, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Ms. Asaibi-George. I have a question about Monia Cass. I know there's a lot of them around the city. It's not just Monia Cass. There's a lot of those camps everywhere. And I just wanted to know what you think about partnering with the governor and other cities. And would you think that you can pull it off to partner with those towns to make sure that other towns take responsibility for the people in need in their town, so that way they don't automatically go to the city where they know they're going to get resources? For instance, every city, Massachusetts, has determined that needs a Veterans Affairs office. So that's the governor said that. So every town and city has a governor's has a Veterans Affairs office. So why can't we do something like that where every city and town has a mental health facility or drug facility or a shelter, temporary housing, traditional housing? Why can't we have that so that other cities and towns, those people in them, can deal with those problems where they are instead of coming to the city and taking up our resources?
Thanks, Yasmin. And just for listeners, we're talking about we covered this earlier in the show, the intersection of Melnia Cass Boulevard and Massachusetts Avenue and the complicated humanitarian issue there with opioid addiction, homelessness, disenfranchisement. Please, Council.
Yes, and thank you very much for that question. And recognizing as much as Mass and Cass, that intersection is the epicenter of the opioid crisis here in the city of Boston, it is also something being experienced, and many vulnerable people are finding themselves in other squares, Andrew Square, Edward Everett Square, Nubian Square, Mattapan Square, Downtown Crossing, Copley Square, across our city. The crisis is playing itself out, but Mass and Cass is the epicenter. And so many individuals are coming to our city for services and not getting really the care and the help that they need when they arrive to this city. And then they're literally and figuratively getting stuck here on our streets and having a terrible and devastating experience. We need to act and act quickly as it relates to this problem. We need to do it, as you mentioned, in partnership with other cities and towns. And I look forward to working with other mayors and town leaders across the greater Boston and beyond area, as well as working in partnership with our governor, Governor Baker and his role as the head of the state also has a special responsibility to connect with and work with other states, because we know this is beyond Massachusetts borders. We need more help, and it's about the response for support of shelter and housing. It's about decentralizing services, making sure that there's opportunity and capacity at detox and long-term recovery.
So let's pick up there. And again, if you're just joining us, we're talking to Boston City Councilor Anicia Saibi-George. She is joining us from her cell phone. The line's a little choppy, but we are sticking with it. This is an important conversation. Part of Yasmin's question was about the regional dimension here. I am thinking just a recent example, resistance from Revere Mayor Brian Arrigo last month. Acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey wanted to use vacant hotel rooms at the Quality Inn for transitional housing and services. Boston's mayor is going to have to get heads of cities and towns on board in a collaborative regional response. But right now, I don't mean to sound crass, but it's not their problem. Boston is sitting at the epicenter of this. So what is the effective message to other mayors, to other communities, to collaborate, spend the resources, take the responsibility?
Well, I think it's about bringing them to the table. And what happened in Revere, from my understanding, because I wasn't involved in that decision-making, was the decision was made, the hotel was leased, and we prepared to send individuals there without collaboration and cooperation from the city of Revere and from leadership in Revere. We need to partner with these other cities and towns and do this work collaboratively with them. And we do track community of origin, and this isn't so much about, you know, sending individuals back to their sending communities. This is about working in partnership with and creating a coordinated response to a crisis. And Boston is bearing the brunt of this crisis. And as much as people and individuals come here for help, there's very little help. And those that are doing the outreach, those that are delivering the care and the services, really are overwhelmed by this crisis. And I know many of those that deliver the care and attempt to deliver the care. I'm down there pretty often at Mass and Cass and in a few other pockets of our city working with those that are delivering those services, and they are overwhelmed by the sheer volume of people who are suffering. And we need help. We just simply need help in this effort, in that we call it the continuum of care here in the city of Boston. That continuum is breaking under the pressure. It's collapsing under the pressure of the devastating need that so many individuals have. So this is about an appropriate public health response. It is also about an appropriate public safety response. There are too many individuals there today, too many people today victimizing the vulnerable.
So let's stay with that.
Victimizing those that are dealing with substance use disorder and mental illness.
So let's stay with that for a second. I have a question for you. I also want to note, since we covered this, Acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey disputed Mayor Arrigo's claims about lack of coordination. But what he emphasized with us was also lack of long-term planning. And listeners can find that coverage on our website. So I want to stay with the public safety piece. You have supported Acting Mayor Janey's move to declare a public health emergency in that area, begin removing tents and temporary shelters. We know we had WBUR's Deb Becker on early in the show. A dozen tents were roughly removed today. You've supported that general approach. Do you feel the city is handling that step appropriately so far?
So first, it was a couple of weeks ago that I stated and shared with the public that on the first day of my administration, we would declare a public health emergency, and I'm grateful for the acting mayor to roll that out earlier. We have already had, for a long period of time, a 48-hour encampment protocol in which we have the opportunity to work with individuals who are living unsheltered, who are staying in tents, to remove those tents, to work with them, to find appropriate shelter, to store their personal belongings, and assist them in their path to recovery. So what has been rolled out over these last couple of days are some policies that have been in place. And I think that it is important that we are working hand in hand with those who are not well, those who are seeking opportunities for treatment, to find appropriate shelter, to find some supportive housing, to participate in some recovery programs. We've got to do that work. I'd also say that this storm the last couple of days has also had a very direct impact on individuals who are
living on the street, who are living unsheltered, who are staying in these tents. If you've been through the Mass and Cass area at all recently, as I've been, I'm there almost every day. It is quite an inhuman way that we've allowed people to be. We have to find support services here in Boston and beyond to help and assist folks that are in trouble. We also need to make sure that we're holding those that are victimizing vulnerable communities of people responsible for their action. So there's a significant amount of serious drug dealing in the Mass and Cass area. There is a significant amount of human trafficking and rape and violence against women. We have to act quicker and hold those that are committing these crimes accountable and help those that are not well get treatment.
I'm going to move us on because we have some calls I'd like to get to. 800-423-8255. Brenier is on the line in Hyde Park. Brenier, go ahead.
Hi, Miss George, good afternoon. I truly am undecided because on the one hand, I agree with you on the housing issue because I totally disagree with Michelle Wu when it comes to housing. Her stunt with Airbnb has hurt me quite a bit. All she did was I have to pay your fee to the city every year. And
Brunier, let's focus happened. On your question.
Okay, my question is, what can Ms. Asaidi tell me to vote for her? Because I have issues with the fact that the police is supporting her. I don't have any problem with the police, but I have problem with qualified immunity. How does she feel about qualified immunity as a black person who's been harassed by the police? I have issues with that, and yet I have issues with Michelle Wu. So if she can tell me something satisfactory for the qualified immunity, she might get my vote.
Thank you, Brenier.
Brenier, thank you very much for that question and the very important work that we have to do immediately to roll out greater accountability and greater transparency in the Boston Police Department. We have to fix the internal affairs process and how our city's residents and constituents file complaints and issue complaints against police officers. We've got to do that work. And day one, I am rolling out and starting the implementation of the recommendations from the Boston Police Task Force around those pieces, especially. And we've got to make sure that we are holding police officers accountable for bad behavior and looking for opportunities to empower our police commissioner to terminate Boston police officers who are acting inappropriately. And, you know, just we've got to do better. When we think about police officers, when we think about public safety in the city, when we think about my responsibility as mayor of this city to have both a safe city and a just city, we've got a lot of work to do.
Could you address Brenier's question about qualified immunity directly?
Yeah, so the qualified immunity piece is always is a complicated issue within police reform that we have to work towards making sure that there are opportunities to hold police officers accountable, let them do their job in keeping our neighborhood safe, and recognizing that when a police officer behaves criminally, that they lose that qualified immunity. And we have to enforce that. We've got to, you know, make sure that that is always a tool that we can access.
Okay, so I want to stay on the police commissioner. You mentioned the importance of the police commissioner a moment ago. I am going to ask you a question that I also asked Michelle Wu yesterday. If elected, you will be in charge of hiring a new commissioner. How long do you anticipate that process will take to complete? And what is something specific that you will look for in a candidate, whether it, you know, past experience, qualifications, that you believe will have real impact on changing the culture in the Boston Police Department?
Well, I'm prepared on day one of my administration to initiate that search. We've gone too long without a police commissioner here in the city of Boston, and I want to do that in partnership with our city's community. It is important that we have a community-facing effort to select our next police commissioner. I do not believe in national searches. We can do that locally. We have talent here in the city of Boston.
I just want to clarify. So it would not be a national search?
I will not conduct a national search. Certainly, if there's individuals from beyond Boston that are interested in serving as police commissioner, they'll find us. But we don't need to exercise a national search. What we need is a community-led search, and I look forward to doing that in partnership with our city's residents, with faith-based organizations, with community-based organizations, with those that have spent a great deal of time thinking about community policing, because that's central to the work that I want the Boston Police Department focused on. And we've got some great talent here. We've got some incredible expertise and experience here in the city of Boston. And it is something that I will be kicking off on the first day of my administration.
And do you have a target time frame in mind for that search?
It has to be done quickly. I haven't limited myself to a sort of a specific timeline, but it shouldn't take very long. We've got to engage the community quickly, and that I'm prepared to do, like literally on day one of my administration, November 16th, we are going to kick that off. So my hope is at the start of the new year, we will have a new police commissioner in place.
Okay, we have another question on policing. I'm going to pick that up. We've got Stephanie and Beacon Hill. And Stephanie, briefly with your question, please.
I need to know what the candidate is doing about the control of the police union's power, in particularly, you know, in cases like, you know, overtime pay that is like, you know, the outrageous. And also, you know, the work, rigid work rules, and also, you know, how they investigate, you know, their own rank and file.
Thank you, Stephanie. And you talked about internal affairs, so maybe you can focus on overtime and the union.
Yeah, we absolutely have got to get a handle on this overtime spending. It is a massive part of the budget as it relates to policing here in the city. And that speaks to a couple of things. One, we are not appropriately staffed. And as we think about increasing the numbers of police officers so that we are a right-sized force, that creates an incredible opportunity to get that better diversity, that deeper diversity, that better reflection of the city in the Boston Police Department. That's important to me and a priority, I know, of the Boston Police Reform Task Force. We also need to make sure that we are managing that overtime, that we are utilizing it only when necessary, and controlling that spending. And then I know that we've already talked a little bit about it before, but we have to fix the internal affairs process from start to finish.
As the overtime problem, so you're arguing causality, more officers, fewer overtime problems. Would you reduce the Boston Police Department budget? Are you advocating for a smaller BPD budget?
So I'm not advocating for a smaller budget. I'm advocating for a real wise use of those dollars and that investment. When we have, you know, up to $70 million spent on overtime, that says we're short-staffed for sure. We need to make sure that our communities have appropriate representation as it relates to police officers in our districts and present in our communities. It also means that we're maybe not planning properly for some of the larger scaled events. We need to right size our staff and make sure that those dollars are invested appropriately into an appropriately sized force.
So given the push to reduce police budgets, to demilitarize the police, to change the focus.
I'm not a proponent of defunding the police. We have a budget that needs to be used appropriately and invested in a police force that is diverse, that is representative and reflective of the city in which it serves, and is meeting the needs of our city's residents. I've done the work as a member of the city council to ensure that that budget is also going towards the co-response model that I've worked on as a member of the city council. We went from 2 to 4 to now 19 co-responders, licensed clinicians that work in partnership with the Boston Police Department to make sure that we are responding to the mental health needs of so many of our residents.
Okay, so lightning round, one sentence on these. Are you in favor of some kind of vaccine passport?
No.
What is your order at Dunkin's?
No, extra large ice, just cream.
And Halloween costume plans for you and the family?
I'm going as a candidate for mayor, and my children are now teenagers, and they're the ones that will be knocking on your door, likely with a pillowcase and maybe an old mask from the toy box.
All right. Mayoral candidate and Boston City Councilor Anissa Asaibi-George, thanks for joining our listeners and answering their questions.
Thank you, TCN. Have a nice afternoon.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beeland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening and calling. Join us tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.